of the daughter and grandson of Theodoric, obeyed their imprudent orders to receive the troops of Justinian like friends and allies. Provisions were liberally supplied, and cavalry was remounted, and Procopius soon returned from Syracuse with correct information of the state and designs of the Vandals. His intelligence determined Belisarius to hasten his operations, and his wise impatience was seconded by the winds. The fleet lost sight of Sicily, passed before the Isle of Malta, discovered the capes of Africa, ran along the coast with a strong gale from the northeast, and finally cast anchor at the promontory of Caput Vada, about 5 days' journey to the south of Carthage. If Gelimer had been informed of the approach of the enemy, he must have delayed the conquest of Sardinia for the immediate defense of his person and kingdom. A detachment of 5,000 soldiers and 120 galleys would have joined the remaining forces of the Vandals, and the descendant of Genseric might have surprised and oppressed a fleet of deep-laden transports, incapable of action, and of light brigantines that seemed only qualified for flight. Belisarius had secretly trembled when he overheard his soldiers in the passage, emboldening each other to confess their apprehensions. If they were once on shore, they hoped to maintain the honour of their arms, but if they should be attacked at sea, they did not blush to acknowledge that they wanted courage to contend at the same time with the winds, the waves, and the barbarians. The knowledge of their sentiments decided Belisarius to seize the first opportunity of landing them on the coast of Africa, and he prudently rejected in a council of war the proposal of sailing with the fleet and army into the port of Carthage. 3 months after their departure from Constantinople, the men and horses, the arms and military stores were safely disembarked, and 5 soldiers were left as a guard on board each of the ships, which were disposed in the form of a semicircle. The remainder of the troops occupied a camp on the seashore, which they fortified, according to ancient discipline, with a ditch and rampart, and the discovery of a source of fresh water, while it allayed the thirst, excited the superstitious confidence of the Romans. The next morning some of the neighboring gardens were pillaged, and Belisarius, after chastising the offenders, embraced the slight occasion, but the decisive moment, of inculcating the maxims of justice, moderation, and genuine policy. When I first accepted the commission of subduing Africa, I depended much less, said the general, on the numbers, or even the bravery of my troops, than on the friendly disposition of the natives and their immortal hatred to the Vandals. You alone can deprive me of this hope. If you continue to extort by rapine what might be purchased for a little money, such acts of violence will reconcile these implacable enemies and unite them in a just and holy league against the invaders of their country. These exhortations were enforced by rigid discipline, of which the soldiers themselves soon felt and praised the salutary effects. The inhabitants, instead of deserting their houses or hiding their corn, supplied the Romans with a fair and liberal market. The civil officers of the province continued to exercise their functions in the name of Justinian, and the clergy, from motives of conscience and interest, assiduously labored to promote the cause of a Catholic emperor. The small town of Sulecti, 1 day's journey from the camp, had the honour of being foremost to open her gates and to resume her ancient allegiance. The larger cities of Leptis and Adrumetum imitated the example of loyalty as soon as Belisarius appeared. And he advanced without opposition as far as Grasse, a palace of the Vandal kings at the distance of 50 miles from Carthage. The weary Romans indulged themselves in the refreshment of shady groves, cool fountains, and delicious fruits, and the preference which Procopius allows to these gardens over any that he had seen either in the east or west may be described either to the taste or the fatigue or the historian. In 3 generations, prosperity and a warm climate had dissolved the hardy virtue of the Vandals, who insensibly became the most luxurious of mankind. In their villas and gardens, which might deserve the Persian name of paradise, they enjoyed a cool and elegant repose, and after the daily use of the bath, the barbarians were seated at a table profusely spread with the delicacies of the land and sea. Their silken robes, loosely flowing after the fashion of the Medes, were embroidered with gold. Love and hunting were the labours of their life, and their vacant hours were amused by pantomimes, chariot races, and the music and dances of the theatre. In a march of 10 or 12 days, the vigilance of Belisarius was constantly awake and active against his unseen enemies, by whom in every place and at every hour he might be suddenly attacked. An officer of confidence and merit, John the Armenian, led the vanguard of 300 horse. 600 Massageti covered at a certain distance the left flank, and the whole fleet, steering along the coast, seldom lost sight of the army, which moved each day about 12 miles, and lodged in the evening in strong camps or in friendly towns. The near approach of the Romans to Carthage filled the mind of Gelimer with anxiety and terror. He prudently wished to protract the war till his brother, with his veteran troops, should return from the conquest of Sardinia, and he now lamented the rash policy of his ancestors, who, by destroying the fortifications of Africa, had left him only the dangerous resource of risking a battle in the neighbourhood of his capital. The Vandal conquerors, from their original number of 50,000, were multiplied, without including their women and children, to 160,000 fighting men. And such forces, animated with valour and union, might have crushed at their first landing the feeble and exhausted bands of the Roman general. But the friends of the captive king were more inclined to accept the invitations than to resist the progress of Belisarius, and many a proud barbarian disguised his aversion to war under the more specious name of his hatred to the usurper. Yet the authority and promises of Gelimer collected a formidable army, and his plans were concerted with some degree of military skill. An order was dispatched to his brother Amatus to collect all the forces of Carthage, and to encounter the van of the Roman army at the distance of 10 miles from the city. His nephew, Gimamund, with 2,000 horse, was destined to attack their left, when the monarch himself, who silently followed, should charge their rear, in a situation which excluded them from the aid or even the view of their fleet. But the rashness of Amatus was fatal to himself and his country. He anticipated the hour of the attack, outstripped his tardy followers, and was pierced with a mortal wound after he had slain with his own hand 12 of his boldest antagonists. His Vandals fled to Carthage. The highway, almost 10 miles, was strewed with dead bodies, and it seemed incredible that such multitudes could be slaughtered by the swords of 300 Romans. The nephew of Gelimer was defeated after a slight combat by the 600 Massageti. They did not equal the third part of his numbers, but each Scythian was fired by the example of his chief, who gloriously exercised the privilege of his family by riding foremost and alone to shoot the first arrow against the enemy. In the meanwhile, Gelimer himself, ignorant of the event and misguided by the windings of the hills, inadvertently passed the Roman army and reached the scene of action where Amatus had fallen. He wept the fate of his brother and of Carthage, charged with irresistible fury the advancing squadrons, and might have pursued and perhaps decided the victory if he had not wasted those inestimable moments in the discharge of a vain, though pious, duty to the dead. While his spirit was broken by this mournful office, he heard the trumpet of Belisarius, who, leaving Antonina and his infantry in the camp, pressed forwards with his guards and the remainder of the cavalry to rally his flying troops and to restore the fortune of the day. Much room could not be found in this disorderly battle for the talents of a general, but the king fled before the hero, and the Vandals, accustomed only to a Moorish enemy, were incapable of withstanding the arms and discipline of the Romans. Gelimer retired with hasty steps towards the desert of Numidia, but he had soon the consolation of learning that his private orders for the execution of Hilderic and his captive friends had been faithfully obeyed. The tyrant's revenge was useful only to his enemies. The death of a lawful prince excited the compassion of his people. His life might have perplexed the victorious Romans, and the lieutenant of Justinian, by a crime of which he was innocent, was relieved from the painful alternative of forfeiting his honour or relinquishing his conquests. Part 2. As soon as the tumult had subsided, the several parts of the army informed each other of the accidents of the day, and Belisarius pitched his camp on the field of victory to which the 10th milestone from Carthage had applied the Latin appellation of Decimus. From a wise suspicion of the stratagems and resources of the Vandals, he marched the next day in order of battle, halted in the evening before the gates of Carthage, and allowed a night of repose that he might not, in darkness and disorder, expose the city to the license of the soldiers, or the soldiers themselves to the secret ambush of the city. But as the fears of Belisarius were the result of calm and intrepid reason, he was soon satisfied that he might confide, without danger, in the peaceful and friendly aspect of the capital. Carthage blazed with innumerable torches, the signals of the public joy. The chain was removed that guarded the entrance of the port. The gates were thrown open, and the people, with acclamations of gratitude, hailed and invited their Roman deliverers. The defeat of the Vandals and the freedom of Africa were announced to the city on the eve of Saint Cyprian, when the churches were already adorned and illuminated for the festival of the martyr, whom 3 centuries of superstition had almost raised to a local deity. The Arians, conscious that their reign had expired, resigned the temple to the Catholics, who rescued their saints from profane hands, performed the holy rites, and loudly proclaimed the creed of Athanasius and Justinian. 1 awful hour reversed the fortunes of the contending parties. The suppliant Vandals, who had so lately indulged the vices of conquerors, sought a humble refuge in the sanctuary of the church, while the merchants of the East were delivered from the deepest dungeon of the palace by their affrighted keeper, who implored the protection of his captives, and showed them, through an aperture in the wall, the sails of the Roman fleet. After their separation from the army, the naval commanders had proceeded with slow caution along the coast till they reached the Hermaean promontory and obtained the first intelligence of the victory of Belisarius. Faithful to his instructions, they would have cast anchor about 20 miles from Carthage if the more skillful seamen had not represented the perils of the shore and the signs of an impending tempest. Still ignorant of the revolution, they declined, however, the rash attempt of forcing the chain of the port, and the adjacent harbour and suburb of Mandrakium were insulted only by the rapine of a private officer who disobeyed and deserted his leaders. But the imperial fleet, advancing with a fair wind, steered through the narrow entrance of Goletta, and occupied in the deep and capacious Lake of Tunis a secure station about 5 miles from the capital. No sooner was Belisarius informed of their arrival than he dispatched orders that the greatest part of the mariners should be immediately landed to join the triumph and to swell the apparent numbers of the Romans. Before he allowed them to enter the gates of Carthage, he exhorted them, in a discourse worthy of himself and the occasion, not to disgrace the glory of their arms, and to remember that the Vandals had been the tyrants, but that they were the deliverers of the Africans, who must now be respected as the voluntary and affectionate subjects of their common sovereign. The Romans marched through the streets in close ranks, prepared for battle if an enemy had appeared. The strict order maintained by the general imprinted on their minds the duty of obedience, and in an age in which custom and impunity almost sanctified the abuse of conquest, the genius of one man repressed the passions of a victorious army. The voice of menace and complaint was silent. The trade of Carthage was not interrupted, While Africa changed her master and her government, the shops continued open and busy, and the soldiers, after sufficient guards had been posted, modestly departed to the houses which were allotted for their reception. Belisarius fixed his residence in the palace, seated himself on the throne of Genseric, accepted and distributed the barbaric spoil, granted their lives to the suppliant Vandals, and laboured to repair the damage which the suburb of Mandrakium had sustained in the preceding night. At supper he entertained his principal officers with the form and magnificence of a royal banquet. The victor was respectfully served by the captive officers of the household, and in the moments of festivity, when the impartial spectators applauded the fortune and merit of Belisarius, his envious flatterers secretly shed their venom on every word and gesture which might alarm the suspicions of a jealous monarch. One day was given to these pompous scenes, which may not be despised as useless if they attracted the popular veneration. But the active mind of Belisarius, which in the pride of victory could suppose a defeat, had already resolved that the Roman Empire in Africa should not depend on the chance of arms or the favour of the people. The fortifications of Carthage had alone been exempted from the general proscription, but in the reign of 95 years they were suffered to decay by the thoughtless and indolent Vandals. A wiser conqueror restored, with incredible dispatch, the walls and ditches of the city. His liberality encouraged the workmen. The soldiers, the mariners, and the citizens vied with each other in the salutary labour, and Gelimer, who had feared to trust his person in an open town, beheld, with astonishment and despair, the rising strength of an impregnable fortress. That unfortunate monarch, after the loss of his capital, applied himself to collect the remains of an army scattered, rather than destroyed, by the preceding battle, and the hopes of pillage attracted some Moorish bands to the standard of Gelimer. He encamped in the fields of Bulla, 4 days' journey from Carthage, insulted the capital, which he deprived of the use of an aqueduct, proposed a high reward for the head of every Roman, affected to spare the persons and property of his African subjects, and secretly negotiated with the Arian sectaries and the confederate Huns. Under these circumstances, the conquest of Sardinia served only to aggravate his distress. He reflected with the deepest anguish that he had wasted in that useless enterprise 5,000 of his bravest troops, and he read with grief and shame the victorious letters of his brother Zano, who expressed a sanguine confidence that the king, after the example of their ancestors, had already chastised the rashness of the Roman invader. "Alas, my brother," replied Gelimer, "heaven has declared against our unhappy nation. While you have subdued Sardinia, we have lost Africa." No sooner did Belisarius appear with a handful of soldiers than courage and prosperity deserted the cause of the Vandals. Your nephew, Gibamunt, your brother, Amatus, have been betrayed to death by the cowardice of their followers. Our horses, our ships, Carthage itself, and all Africa are in the power of the enemy. Yet the Vandals still prefer an ignominious repose at the expense of their wives and children, their wealth and liberty. Nothing now remains except the fields of Bulla and the hope of your valour. Abandon Sardinia, fly to our relief, restore our empire, or perish by our side." On the receipt of this epistle, Zano imparted his grief to the principal Vandals, but the intelligence was prudently concealed from the natives of the island. The troops embarked in 120 galleys at the port of Cagliari, cast anchor the third day on the confines of Mauritania, and hastily pursued their march to join the royal standard in the camp of Bulla. Mournful was the interview. The two brothers embraced. They wept in silence. No questions were asked of the Sardinian victory. No inquiries were made of the African misfortunes. They saw before their eyes the whole extent of their calamities, and the absence of their wives and children afforded a melancholy proof that either death or captivity had been their lot. The languid spirit of the Vandals was at length awakened, and united by the entreaties of their king, the example of Zano, and the instant danger which threatened their monarchy and religion. The military strength of the nation advanced to battle, and such was the rapid increase that before their army reached Tricameron, about 20 miles from Carthage, they might boast, perhaps with some exaggeration, that they surpassed in a tenfold proportion the diminutive powers of the Romans. But these powers were under the command of Belisarius, and as he was conscious of their superior merit, he permitted the barbarians to surprise him at an unseasonable hour. The Romans were instantly under arms. A rivulet covered their front. The cavalry formed the first line, which Belisarius supported in the center at the head of 500 guards. The infantry, at some distance, was posted in the second line, and the vigilance of the general watched the separate station and ambiguous faith of the Massageti, who secretly reserved their aid for the conquerors. The historian has asserted, and the reader may easily supply, the speeches of the commanders, who, by arguments the most apposite to their situation, inculcated the importance of victory and the contempt of life. Zano, with the troops which had followed him to the conquest of Sardinia, was placed in the center, and the throne of Genseric might have stood if the multitude of Vandals had imitated their intrepid resolution. Casting away their lances and missile weapons, they drew their swords and expected the charge. The Roman cavalry thrice passed the rivulet. They were thrice repulsed, and the conflict was firmly maintained, till Zano fell, and the standard of Belisarius was displayed. Gelimer retreated to his camp. The Huns joined the pursuit, and the victors despoiled the bodies of the slain. Yet no more than 50 Romans and 800 Vandals were found on the field of battle, so inconsiderable was the carnage of a day which extinguished a nation and transferred the empire of Africa. In the evening Belisarius led his infantry to the attack of the camp, and the pusillanimous flight of Gelimer exposed the vanity of his recent declarations that to the vanquished death was a relief, life a burden, and infamy the only object of terror. His departure was secret, but as soon as the Vandals discovered that their king had deserted them, they hastily dispersed, anxious only for their personal safety and careless of every object that is dear or valuable to mankind. The Romans entered the camp without resistance, and the wildest scenes of disorder were veiled in the darkness and confusion of the night. Every barbarian who met their swords was inhumanly massacred. Their widows and daughters, as rich heirs or beautiful concubines, were embraced by the licentious soldiers, and avarice itself was almost satiated with the treasures of gold and silver, the accumulated fruits of conquest or economy in a long period of prosperity and peace. In this frantic search, the troops, even of Belisarius, forgot their caution and respect. Intoxicated with lust and rapine, they explored in small parties or alone the adjacent fields, the woods, the rocks, and the caverns that might possibly conceal any desirable prize. Laden with booty, they deserted their ranks and wandered without a guide on the high road to Carthage. And if the flying enemies had dared to return, very few of the conquerors would have escaped. Deeply sensible of the disgrace and danger, Belisarius passed an apprehensive night on the field of victory. At the dawn of day, he planted his standard on a hill, recalled his guardians and veterans, and gradually restored the modesty and obedience of the camp. It was equally the concern of the Roman general to subdue the hostile and to save the prostrate barbarian, and the suppliant Vandals, who could be found only in churches, were protected by his authority, disarmed and separately confined, that they might neither disturb the public peace nor become the victims of popular revenge. After dispatching a light detachment to tread the footsteps of Gelimer, He advanced with his whole army about 10 days' march as far as Hyperegius, which no longer possessed the relics of St. Augustine. The season and the certain intelligence that the Vandal had fled to an inaccessible country of the Moors determined Belisarius to relinquish the vain pursuit and to fix his winter quarters at Carthage. From thence he dispatched his principal lieutenant to inform the emperor that in the space of 3 months he had achieved the conquest of Africa. Belisarius spoke the language of truth. The surviving Vandals yielded, without resistance, their arms and their freedom. The neighborhood of Carthage submitted to his presence, and the more distant provinces were successively subdued by the report of his victory. Tripoli was confirmed in her voluntary allegiance. Sardinia and Corsica surrendered to an officer who carried, instead of a sword, the head of the valiant Zano, and the isles of Majorca, Minorca, and Ibica consented to remain a humble appendage of the African kingdom. Caesarea, a royal city which in looser geography may be confounded with the modern Algiers, was situated 30 days' march to the westward of Carthage. By land the road was infested by the Moors, but the sea was open, and the Romans were now masters of the sea. An active and discreet tribune sailed as far as the Straits, where he occupied Septim, or Ceuta, which rises opposite to Gibraltar on the African coast. That remote place was afterwards adorned and fortified by Justinian, and he seems to have indulged the vain ambition of extending his empire to the columns of Hercules. He received the messengers of victory at the time when he was preparing to publish the Pandects of the Roman laws, and the devout or jealous emperor celebrated the divine goodness and confessed in silence the merit of his successful general. Impatient to abolish the temporal and spiritual tyranny of the Vandals, he proceeded without delay to the full establishment of the Catholic Church. Her jurisdiction, wealth, and immunities, perhaps the most essential part of episcopal religion, were restored and amplified with a liberal hand. The Arian worship was suppressed, the Donatist meetings were proscribed, and the Synod of Carthage, by the voice of 217 bishops, applauded the just measure of pious retaliation. On such an occasion it may not be presumed that many Orthodox prelates were absent, but the comparative smallness of their number, which in ancient councils had been twice or even thrice multiplied, most clearly indicates the decay both of the church and state. While Justinian approved himself the defender of the faith, he entertained an ambitious hope that his victorious lieutenant would speedily enlarge the narrow limits of his dominion to the space which they occupied before the invasion of the Moors and Vandals. And Belisarius was instructed to establish 5 dukes or commanders in the convenient stations of Tripoli, Leptis, Cirta, Caesarea, and Sardinia, and to compute the military force of palatines or borderers that might be sufficient for the defense of Africa. The kingdom of the Vandals was not unworthy of the presence of a praetorian prefect, and 4 consulars, 3 presidents, were appointed to administer the 7 provinces under his civil jurisdiction. The number of their subordinate officers, clerks, messengers, or assistants was minutely expressed. 396 for the prefect himself, 50 for each of his vice-regents, and the rigid definition of their fees and salaries was more effectual to confirm the right than to prevent the abuse. These magistrates might be oppressive, but they were not idle, and the subtle questions of justice and revenue were infinitely propagated under the new government, which professed to revive the freedom and equity of the Roman Republic. The conqueror was solicitous to extract a prompt and plentiful supply from his African subjects, and he allowed them to claim, even in the 3rd degree and from the collateral line, the houses and lands of which their families had been unjustly despoiled by the Vandals. After the departure of Belisarius, who acted by a high and special commission, no ordinary provision was made for a master general of the forces. But the office of Praetorian Prefect was entrusted to a soldier, The civil and military powers were united, according to the practice of Justinian, in the chief governor, and the representative of the emperor in Africa, as well as in Italy, was soon distinguished by the appellation of Exarch. Yet the conquest of Africa was imperfect till her former sovereign was delivered, either alive or dead, into the hands of the Romans. Doubtful of the event, Gelimer had given secret orders that a part of his treasure should be transported to Spain, where he hoped to find a secure refuge at the court of the king of the Visigoths. But these intentions were disappointed by accident, treachery, and the indefatigable pursuit of his enemies, who intercepted his flight from the seashore and chased the unfortunate monarch with some faithful followers to the inaccessible mountain of Papua in the inland country of Numidia. He was immediately besieged by Pharas, an officer whose truth and sobriety were the more applauded, as such qualities could seldom be found among the Heruli, the most corrupt of the barbarian tribes. To his vigilance, Belisarius had entrusted this important charge, and after a bold attempt to scale the mountain in which he lost 110 soldiers, Pharas expected during a winter siege the operation of distress and famine on the mind of the Vandal king. From the softest habits of pleasure, from the unbounded command of industry and wealth, he was reduced to share the poverty of the Moors, supportable only to themselves by their ignorance of a happier condition. In their rude hovels of mud and hurdles, which confined the smoke and excluded the light, they promiscuously slept on the ground, perhaps on a sheepskin, with their wives, their children, and their cattle. Sordid and scanty were their garments. The use of bread and wine was unknown, and their oaten or barley cakes, imperfectly baked in the ashes, were devoured almost in a crude state by the hungry savages. The health of Gelimer must have sunk under these strange and unwonted hardships from whatsoever cause they had been endured. But his actual misery was embittered by the recollection of past greatness, the daily insolence of his protectors, and the just apprehension that the light and venal Moors might be tempted to betray the rites of hospitality. The knowledge of his situation dictated the humane and friendly epistle of Pharas. "Like yourself," said the chief of the Heruli, "I am an illiterate barbarian, but I speak the language of plain sense and an honest heart. Why will you persist in hopeless obstinacy? Why will you ruin yourself, your family, and nation? The love of freedom and abhorrence of slavery? Alas, my dearest Gelimer, are you not already the worst of slaves, the slave of the vile nation of the Moors? Would it not be preferable to sustain at Constantinople a life of poverty and servitude, rather than to reign the undoubted monarch of the mountain of Papua? Do you think it is a disgrace to be the subject of Justinian? Belisarius is his subject, and we ourselves, whose birth is not inferior to your own, are not ashamed of our obedience to the Roman Emperor. That generous prince will grant you a rich inheritance of lands, a place in the Senate, and the dignity of patrician. Such are his gracious intentions, and you may depend with full assurance on the word of Belisarius. So long as heaven has condemned us to suffer, patience is a virtue. But if we reject the proffered deliverance, it degenerates into blind and stupid despair." "I am not insensible," replied the king of the Vandals. "How kind and rational is your advice. But I cannot persuade myself to become the slave of an unjust enemy who has deserved my implacable hatred. Him I had never injured either by word or deed. Yet he has sent against me, I know not from whence, a certain Belisarius, who has cast me headlong from the throne into his abyss of misery. Justinian is a man. He is a prince. Does he not dread for himself a similar reverse of fortune? I can write no more. My grief oppresses me. Send me, I beseech you, my dear Pharos, send me a lyre, a sponge, and a loaf of bread. From the Vandal messenger, Pharos was informed of the motives of this singular request. It was long since the king of Africa had tasted bread. A defluxion had fallen on his eyes, the effect of fatigue or incessant weeping, and he wished to solace the melancholy hours by singing to the lyre the sad story of his own misfortunes. The humanity of Pharos was moved. He sent the three extraordinary gifts, but even his humanity prompted him to redouble the vigilance of his guard, that he might sooner compel his prisoner to embrace a resolution advantageous to the Romans, but salutary to himself. The obstinacy of Gelimer at length yielded to reason and necessity. The solemn assurances of safety and honorable treatment were ratified in the emperor's name by the ambassador of Belisarius, and the king of the Vandals descended from the mountain. The first public interview was in one of the suburbs of Carthage, and when the royal captive accosted his conqueror, he burst into a fit of laughter. The crowd might naturally believe that extreme grief had deprived Gelimer of his senses, but in this mournful state, unseasonable mirth insinuated to more intelligent observers that the vain and transitory scenes of human greatness are unworthy of a serious thought. Their contempt was soon justified by a new example of a vulgar truth, that flattery adheres to power, and envy to superior merit. The chiefs of the Roman army presumed to think themselves the rivals of a hero. Their private dispatches maliciously affirmed that the conqueror of Africa, strong in his reputation and the public love, conspired to seat himself on the throne of the Vandals. Justinian listened with too patient an ear, and his silence was the result of jealousy rather than of confidence. An honorable alternative of remaining in the province or of returning to the capital was indeed submitted to the discretion of Belisarius, but he wisely concluded from intercepted letters and the knowledge of his sovereign's temper that he must either resign his head, erect his standard, or confound his enemies by his presence and submission. Innocence and courage decided his choice. His guards, captives, and treasures were diligently embarked, and so prosperous was the navigation that his arrival at Constantinople preceded any certain account of his departure from the port of Carthage. Such unsuspecting loyalty removed the apprehensions of Justinian. Envy was silenced and inflamed by the public gratitude, and the third Africanus obtained the honors of a triumph, a ceremony which the city of Constantine had never seen, and which ancient Rome, since the reign of Tiberius, had reserved for the auspicious arms of the Caesars. From the palace of Belisarius, the procession was conducted through the principal streets to the Hippodrome, and this memorable day seemed to avenge the injuries of Genseric and to expiate the shame of the Romans. The wealth of nations was displayed, the trophies of martial or effeminate luxury, rich armor, golden thrones, and the chariots of state which had been used by the Vandal queen. The massy furniture of the royal banquet, the splendor of precious stones, the elegant forms of statues and vases, the more substantial treasure of gold, and the holy vessels of the Jewish temple, which, after their long peregrination, were respectfully deposited in the Christian church of Jerusalem. A long train of the noblest Vandals reluctantly exposed their lofty stature and manly countenance. Gelimer slowly advanced. He was clad in a purple robe and still maintained the majesty of a king. Not a tear escaped from his eyes, not a sigh was heard, but his pride or piety derived some secret consolation from the words of Solomon, which he repeatedly pronounced, "Vanity, vanity, all is vanity." Instead of ascending a triumphal car drawn by four horses or elephants, the modest conqueror marched on foot at the head of his brave companions. His prudence might decline an honour too conspicuous for a subject, and his magnanimity might justly disdain what had been so often sullied by the vilest of tyrants. The glorious procession entered the gate of the Hippodrome, was saluted by the acclamations of the Senate and people, and halted before the throne where Justinian and Theodora were seated to receive homage of the captive monarch and the victorious hero. They both performed the customary adoration, and falling prostrate on the ground, respectfully touched the footstool of a prince who had not unsheathed his sword, and of a prostitute who had danced on the theatre. Some gentle violence was used to bend the stubborn spirit of the grandson of Genseric, and, however trained to servitude, the genius of Belisarius must have secretly rebelled. He was immediately declared consul for the ensuing year, and the day of his inauguration resembled the pomp of a second triumph. His curule chair was borne aloft on the shoulders of captive Vandals, and the spoils of war, gold cups and rich girdles, were profusely scattered among the populace. Part 3. But the purest reward of Belisarius was in the faithful execution of a treaty for which his honour had been pledged to the king of the Vandals. The religious scruples of Gelimer, who adhered to the Arian heresy, were incompatible with the dignity of senator or patrician. But he received from the emperor an ample estate in the province of Galatia, where the abdicated monarch retired, with his family and friends, to a life of peace, of affluence, and perhaps of content. The daughters of Hilderic were entertained with the respectful tenderness due to their age and misfortune, and Justinian and Theodora accepted the honour of educating and enriching the female descendants of the great Theodosius. The bravest of the Vandal youth were distributed into 5 squadrons of cavalry which adopted the name of their benefactor, and supported in the Persian wars the glory of their ancestors. But these rare exceptions, the reward of birth or valour, are insufficient to explain the fate of a nation whose numbers before a short and bloodless war amounted to more than 600,000 persons. After the exile of their king and nobles, the servile crowd might purchase their safety by abjuring their character, religion, and language, and their degenerate posterity would be insensibly mingled with the common herd of African subjects. Yet even in the present age and in the heart of the Moorish tribes, a curious traveller has discovered the white complexion and long flaxen hair of a northern race, and it was formerly believed that the boldest of the Vandals fled before the power or even the knowledge of the Romans to enjoy their solitary freedom on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean. Africa had been their empire. It became their prison. Nor could they entertain a hope or even a wish of returning to the banks of the Elbe, where their brethren, of a spirit less adventurous, still wandered in their native forests. It was impossible for cowards to surmount the barriers of unknown seas and hostile barbarians. It was impossible for brave men to expose their nakedness and defeat before the eyes of their countrymen, to describe the kingdoms which they had lost and to claim a share of the humble inheritance which, in a happier hour, they had almost unanimously renounced. In the country between the Elbe and the Oder, several populous villages of Lusatia are inhabited by the Vandals. They still preserve their language, their customs, and the purity of their blood, support with some impatience the Saxon or Prussian yoke, and serve with secret and voluntary allegiance the descendant of their ancient kings, who in his garb and present fortune is confounded with the meanest of his vassals. The name and situation of this unhappy people might indicate their descent from one common stock with the conquerors of Africa, but the use of a Sclavonian dialect more clearly represent them as the last remnant of the new colonies who succeeded to the genuine Vandals, already scattered or destroyed in the age of Procopius. If Belisarius had been tempted to hesitate in his allegiance, he might have urged, even against the emperor himself, the indispensable duty of saving Africa from an enemy more barbarous than the Vandals. The origin of the Moors is involved in darkness. They were ignorant of the use of letters. Their limits cannot be precisely defined. A boundless continent was open to the Libyan shepherds. The change of seasons and pastures regulated their motions, and their rude huts and slender furniture were transported with the same case as their arms, their families, and their cattle, which consisted of sheep, oxen, and camels. During the vigor of the Roman power, they observed a respectful distance from Carthage and the seashore. Under the feeble reign of the Vandals, they invaded the cities of Numidia, occupied the seacoast from Tangier to Caesarea, and pitched their camps with impunity in the fertile province of Byzacium. The formidable strength and artful conduct of Belisarius secured the neutrality of the Moorish princes, whose vanity aspired to receive, in the emperor's name, the ensigns of their regal dignity. They were astonished by the rapid event, and trembled in the presence of their conqueror. But his approaching departure soon relieved the apprehensions of a savage and superstitious people. The number of their wives allowed them to disregard the safety of their infant hostages. And when the Roman general hoisted sail in the port of Carthage, he heard the cries and almost beheld the flames of the desolated province. Yet he persisted in his resolution, and leaving only a part of his guards to reinforce the feeble garrisons, he entrusted the command of Africa to the eunuch Solomon, who proved himself not unworthy to be the successor of Belisarius. In the first invasion, some detachments with two officers of merit were surprised and intercepted. But Solomon speedily assembled his troops, marched from Carthage into the heart of the country, and in two great battles destroyed 60,000 of the barbarians. The Moors depended on their multitude, their swiftness, and their inaccessible mountains, and the aspect and smell of their camels are said to have produced some confusion in the Roman cavalry. But as soon as they were commanded to dismount, they derided this contemptible obstacle. As soon as the columns ascended the hills, the naked and disorderly crowd were dazzled by glittering arms and regular evolutions. And the menace of their female prophets was repeatedly fulfilled, that the Moors should be discomfited by a beardless antagonist. The victorious eunuch advanced 13 days' journey from Carthage to besiege Mount Auracius, the citadel, and at the same time the garden of Numidia. That range of hills, a branch of the great Atlas, contains within a circumference of 120 miles a rare variety of soil and climate. The intermediate valleys and elevated plains abound with rich pastures, perpetual streams, and fruits of a delicious taste and uncommon magnitude. This fair solitude is decorated with the ruins of Lambesa, a Roman city, once the seat of a legion and the residence of 40,000 inhabitants. The Ionic temple of Aesculapius is encompassed with Moorish huts, and the cattle now graze in the midst of an amphitheater, under the shade of Corinthian columns. A sharp perpendicular rock rises above the level of the mountain, where the African princes deposited their wives and treasure. And a proverb is familiar to the Arabs, that the man may eat fire who dares to attack the craggy cliffs and inhospitable natives of Mount Auracius. This hardy enterprise was twice attempted by the eunuch Solomon. From the first he retreated with some disgrace, and in the second his patience and provisions were almost exhausted. And he must again have retired if he had not yielded to the impetuous courage of his troops, who audaciously scaled, to the astonishment of the Moors, the mountain, the hostile camp, and the summit of the Geminian rock. A citadel was erected to secure this important conquest, and to remind the barbarians of their defeat. And as Solomon pursued his march to the west, the long-lost province of Mauritanian Sitifi was again annexed to the Roman Empire. The Moorish War continued several years after the departure of Belisarius, but the laurels which he resigned to a faithful lieutenant may be justly ascribed to his own triumph. The experience of past faults, which may sometimes correct the mature age of an individual, is seldom profitable to the successive generations of mankind. The nations of antiquity, careless of each other's safety, were separately vanquished and enslaved by the Romans. This awful lesson might have instructed the barbarians of the West to oppose, with timely counsels and confederate arms, the unbounded ambition of Justinian. Yet the same error was repeated, the same consequences were felt, and the Goths, both of Italy and Spain, insensible of their approaching danger, beheld with indifference and even with joy the rapid downfall of the Vandals. After the failure of the royal line, Theudes, a valiant and powerful chief, ascended the throne of Spain, which he had formerly administered in the name of Theodoric and his infant grandson. Under his command, the Visigoths besieged the fortress of Ceuta on the African coast. But while they spent the Sabbath day in peace and devotion, the pious security of their camp was invaded by a sally from the town. And the king himself, with some difficulty and danger, escaped from the hands of a sacrilegious enemy. It was not long before his pride and resentment were gratified by a suppliant embassy from the unfortunate Gelimer, who implored in his distress the aid of the Spanish monarchy. But instead of sacrificing these unworthy passions to the dictates of generosity and prudence, Theudes amused the ambassadors till he was secretly informed of the loss of Carthage, and then dismissed them with obscure and contemptuous advice to seek in their native country a true knowledge of the state of the Vandals. The long continuance of the Italian war delayed the punishment of the Visigoths, and the eyes of Theudes were closed before they tasted the fruits of his mistaken policy. After his death, the scepter of Spain was disputed by a civil war. The weaker candidate solicited the protection of Justinian, and ambitiously subscribed a treaty of alliance, which deeply wounded the independence and happiness of his country. Several cities, both on the ocean and the Mediterranean, were ceded to the Roman troops, who afterwards refused to evacuate those pledges, as it should seem, either of safety or payment. And as they were fortified by perpetual supplies from Africa, they maintained their impregnable stations, for the mischievous purpose of inflaming the civil and religious factions of the barbarians. 70 years elapsed before this painful thorn could be extirpated from the bosom of the monarchy, and as long as the emperors retained any share of these remote and useless possessions, their vanity might number Spain in the list of their provinces, and the successors of Alaric in the rank of their vassals. The error of the Goths who reigned in Italy was less excusable than that of their Spanish brethren, and their punishment was still more immediate and terrible. From a motive of private revenge, they enabled their most dangerous enemy to destroy their most valuable ally. A sister of the great Theodoric had been given in marriage to Thrasimund, the African king. On this occasion, the fortress of Lilybaeum in Sicily was resigned to the Vandals, and the princess Amalafrida was attended by a martial train of 1,000 nobles and 5,000 Gothic soldiers who signalized their valor in the Moorish wars. Their merit was overrated by themselves and perhaps neglected by the Vandals. They viewed the country with envy and the conquerors with disdain, but their real or fictitious conspiracy was prevented by a massacre. The Goths were oppressed, and the captivity of Amalafrida was soon followed by her secret and suspicious death. The eloquent pen of Cassiodorus was employed to reproach the Vandal court with the cruel violation of every social and public duty. But the vengeance which he threatened in the name of his sovereign might be derided with impunity as long as Africa was protected by the sea, and the Goths were destitute of a navy. In the blind impotence of grief and indignation, they joyfully saluted the approach of the Romans, entertained the fleet of Belisarius in the ports of Sicily, and were speedily delighted or alarmed by the surprising intelligence that their revenge was executed beyond the measure of their hopes, or perhaps of their wishes. To their friendship, the emperor was indebted for the kingdom of Africa, and the Goths might reasonably think that they were entitled to resume the possession of a barren rock so recently separated as a nuptial gift from the island of Sicily. they were soon undeceived by the haughty mandate of Belisarius, which excited their tardy and unavailing repentance. "The city and promontory of Lilybaeum," said the Roman general, "belonged to the Vandals, and I claim them by the right of conquest. Your submission may deserve the favour of the emperor. Your obstinacy will provoke his displeasure, and must kindle a war that can terminate only in your utter ruin. If you compel us to take up arms, we shall contend not to regain the possession of a single city, but to deprive you of all the provinces which you unjustly withhold from their lawful sovereign." A nation of 200,000 soldiers might have smiled at the vain menace of Justinian and his lieutenant, but a spirit of discord and disaffection prevailed in Italy, and the Goths supported with reluctance the indignity of a female reign. The birth of Amalasuntha, the regent and queen of Italy, united the two most illustrious families of the barbarians. Her mother, the sister of Clovis, was descended from the long-haired kings of the Merovingian race, and the regal succession of the Amale was illustrated in the 11th generation by her father, the great Theodoric, whose merit might have ennobled a plebeian origin. The sex of his daughter excluded her from the Gothic throne, but his vigilant tenderness for his family and his people discovered the last heir of the royal line, whose ancestors had taken refuge in Spain, and the fortunate Eutharic was suddenly exalted to the rank of a consul and a prince. He enjoyed only a short time the charms of Amalasuntha and the hopes of the succession, and his widow, after the death of her husband and father, was left the guardian of her son Athalaric and the kingdom of Italy. At the age of about 28 years, the endowments of her mind and person had attained their perfect maturity. Her beauty, which in the apprehension of Theodora herself might have disputed the conquest of an emperor, was animated by manly sense, activity, and resolution. Education and experience had cultivated her talents. Her philosophic studies were exempt from vanity, and though she expressed herself with equal elegance and ease in the Greek, the Latin, and the Gothic tongue, the daughter of Theodoric maintained in her councils a discreet and impenetrable silence. By a faithful imitation of the virtues, she revived the prosperity of his reign, while she strove with pious care to expiate the faults and to obliterate the darker memory of his declining age. The children of Boethius and Symmachus were restored to their paternal inheritance. Her extreme lenity never consented to inflict any corporal or pecuniary penalties on her Roman subjects, and she generously despised the clamours of the Goths, who at the end of 40 years still considered the people of Italy as their slaves, or their enemies. Her salutary measures were directed by the wisdom and celebrated by the eloquence of Cassiodorus. She solicited and deserved the friendship of the emperor, and the kingdoms of Europe respected, both in peace and war, the majesty of the Gothic throne. But the future happiness of the queen and of Italy depended on the education of her son, who was destined, by his birth, to support the different and almost incompatible characters of the chief of a barbarian camp and the first magistrate of a civilized nation. From the age of 10 years, Athalaric was diligently instructed in the arts and sciences, either useful or ornamental for a Roman prince, and 3 venerable Goths were chosen to instill the principles of honour and virtue into the mind of their young king. But the pupil who is insensible of the benefits must abhor the restraints of education, and the solicitude of the queen, which affection rendered anxious and severe, offended the untractable nature of her son and his subjects. On a solemn festival, when the Goths were assembled in the palace of Ravenna, the royal youth escaped from his mother's apartment, and with tears of pride and anger complained of a blow which his stubborn disobedience had provoked her to inflict. The barbarians resented the indignity which had been offered to their king, accused the regent of conspiring against his life and crown, and imperiously demanded that the grandson of Theodoric should be rescued from the dastardly discipline of women and pedants, and educated like a valiant Goth in the society of his equals and the glorious ignorance of his ancestors. To this rude clamour, importunately urged as the voice of the nation, Amalasontha was compelled to yield her reason and the dearest wishes of her heart. The king of Italy was abandoned to wine, to women, and to rustic sports, and the indiscreet contempt of the ungrateful youth betrayed the mischievous designs of his favourites and her enemies. Encompassed with domestic foes, she entered into a secret negotiation with the Emperor Justinian, obtained the assurance of a friendly reception, and had actually deposited at Dyrrachium in Epirus a treasure of 40,000 pounds of gold. Happy would it have been for her fame and safety if she had calmly retired from barbarous faction to the peace and splendour of Constantinople. But the mind of Amalasontha was inflamed by ambition and revenge, and while her ships lay at anchor in the port, she waited for the success of a crime which her passions excused or applauded as an act of justice. Three of the most dangerous malcontents had been separately removed under the pretense of trust and command to the frontiers of Italy. They were assassinated by her private emissaries, and the blood of these noble Goths rendered the Queen Mother absolute in the court of Ravenna, and justly odious to a free people. But if she had lamented the disorders of her son, she soon wept her irreparable loss, and the death of Athalaric, who at the age of 16 was consumed by premature intemperance, left her destitute of any firm support or legal authority. Instead of submitting to the laws of her country, which held as a fundamental maxim that the succession could never pass from the lance to the distaff, the daughter of Theodoric conceived the impracticable design of sharing with one of her cousins the regal title, and of reserving in her own hands the substance of supreme power. He received the proposal with profound respect and affected gratitude, and the eloquent Cassiodorus announced to the Senate and the Emperor that Amalasontha and Theodatus had ascended the throne of Italy. His birth, for his mother was the sister of Theodoric, might be considered as an imperfect title, and the choice of Amalasontha was more strongly directed by her contempt of his avarice and pusillanimity, which had deprived him of the love of the Italians and the esteem of the barbarians. But Theodatus was exasperated by the contempt which he deserved. Her justice had repressed and reproached the oppression which he exercised against his Tuscan neighbours, and the principal Goths, united by common guilt and resentment, conspire to instigate his slow and timid disposition. The letters of congratulation were scarcely dispatched before the Queen of Italy was imprisoned in a small island of the Lake of Bolsena, where, after a short confinement, she was strangled in the bath by the order or with the connivance of the new king, who instructed his turbulent subjects to shed the blood of their sovereigns. Justinian beheld with joy the dissensions of the Goths, and the mediation of an ally concealed and promoted the ambitious views of the conqueror. His ambassadors, in their public audience, demanded the fortress of Lilybaeum, 10 barbarian fugitives, and a just compensation for the pillage of a small town on the Illyrian borders. But they secretly negotiated with Theodatus to betray the province of Tuscany, and tempted Amalasontha to extricate herself from danger and perplexity by a free surrender of the kingdom of Italy. A false and servile epistle was subscribed by the reluctant hand of the captive queen. But the confession of the Roman senators who were sent to Constantinople revealed the truth of her deplorable situation. And Justinian, by the voice of a new ambassador, most powerfully interceded for her life and liberty. Yet the secret instructions of the same minister were adapted to serve the cruel jealousy of Theodora, who dreaded the presence and superior charms of a rival. He prompted, with artful and ambiguous hints, the execution of a crime so useful to the Romans. received the intelligence of her death with grief and indignation, and denounced in his master's name immortal war against the perfidious assassin. In Italy, as well as in Africa, the guilt of a usurper appeared to justify the arms of Justinian. But the forces which he prepared were insufficient for the subversion of a mighty kingdom, if their feeble numbers had not been multiplied by the name, the spirit, and the conduct of a hero. A chosen group of guards, who served on horseback and were armed with lances and bucklers, attended the person of Belisarius. His cavalry was composed of 200 Huns, 300 Moors, and 4,000 Confederates, and the infantry consisted of only 3,000 Isaurians. Steering the same course as in his former expedition, the Roman consul cast anchor before Catana in Sicily to survey the strength of the island, and to decide whether he should attempt the conquest or peaceably pursue his voyage for the African coast. He found a fruitful land and a friendly people. Notwithstanding the decay of agriculture, Sicily still supplied the granaries of Rome. The farmers were graciously exempted from the oppression of military quarters, and the guards, who trusted the defense of the island to the inhabitants, had some reason to complain that their confidence was ungratefully betrayed. Instead of soliciting and expecting the aid of the King of Italy, they yielded to the first summons of a cheerful obedience. And this province, the first fruits of the Punic War, was again, after a long separation, united to the Roman Empire. The Gothic garrison of Palermo, which alone attempted to resist, was reduced after a short siege by a singular stratagem. Belisarius introduced his ships into the deepest recess of the harbour. Their boats were laboriously hoisted with ropes and pulleys to the topmast head, and he filled them with archers, who, from that superior station, commanded the ramparts of the city. After this easy, though successful, campaign, the conqueror entered Syracuse in triumph at the head of his victorious bands, distributing gold medals to the people on the day which so gloriously terminated the year of the consulship. He passed the winter season in the palace of ancient kings, amidst the ruins of a Grecian colony, which once extended to a circumference of 22 miles. But in the spring, about the festival of Easter, the prosecution of his designs was interrupted by a dangerous revolt of the African forces. Carthage was saved by the presence of Belisarius, who suddenly landed with 1,000 guards. 2,000 soldiers of doubtful faith returned to the standard of their old commander, and he marched, without hesitation, above 50 miles to seek an enemy whom he affected to pity and despise. 8,000 rebels trembled at his approach. They were routed at the first onset by the dexterity of their master, and this ignoble victory would have restored the peace of Africa if the conqueror had not been hastily recalled to Sicily to appease a sedition which was kindled during his absence in his own camp. Disorder and disobedience were the common malady of the times. The genius to command and the virtue to obey resided only in the mind of Belisarius. Part 4. Although Theodatus descended from a race of heroes, he was ignorant of the art and averse to the dangers of war. Although he had studied the writings of Plato and Tully, philosophy was incapable of purifying his mind from the basest passions, avarice and fear. He had purchased a scepter by ingratitude and murder. At the first menace of an enemy, he degraded his own majesty and that of a nation which already disdained their unworthy sovereign. Astonished by the recent example of Gelimer, he saw himself dragged in chains through the streets of Constantinople. The terrors which Belisarius inspired were heightened by the eloquence of Peter, the Byzantine ambassador, and that bold and subtle advocate persuaded him to sign a treaty too ignominious to become the foundation of a lasting peace. It was stipulated that in the acclamations of the Roman people, the name of the emperor should be always proclaimed before that of the Gothic king, and that as often as the statue of Theodatus was erected in brass on marble, the divine image of Justinian should be placed on its right hand.